Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Thank you, Jay. Coming up on today's programme, as the Iraqi army begins its campaign to rid Mosul of Daesh, the government has made the decision to task Shia militias with a similar role in the northern town of Hawija. The local Sunni population has expressed its concerns about this, and we'll be asking why.
US journalist and documentary maker Daya Schlossberg has been charged with three counts of federal conspiracy, which could combine to a jail sentence of up to 45 years. The charges were levelled following her arrest for filming and reporting on a protest at a tar sands oil pipeline in North Dakota.
Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte has hit the headlines again after telling Al Jazeera that he intends to investigate accusations of extrajudicial killings under his leadership. But we asked just how likely he'd be to see criminal charges brought for such crimes, even if he were to uncover them.
The TV news network RT has had its UK bank accounts closed by the RBS Banking Group. According to a letter sent by the banking group's subsidiary NatWest Bank, the bank's decision is final and not open to discussion.
And how best to marry your inner male and female sides? Well, one woman from Estonia has a very literal solution.
All that and more over the next half hour on this Monday edition of World in Focus. As the Iraqi army begins the push to liberate Mosul from Daesh's grip, Shia militias are tasked with carrying out an offensive on a town in the north, which is also occupied by ISIS. However, locals of Hawija have expressed serious concern about what those Shia militias might do when they get there. Sputnik's Matthew Ayton has more.
While Iraqi government forces launched their offensive on ISIL-held Mosul, Shiite militias are being positioned in Hawija, a much smaller city 60 miles to the north. The decision to steer the Shiite fighters away from Mosul is a move intended to pacify sectarian tensions during the fight for the city, which is expected to be the largest battle in Iraq since the Anglo-American invasion of 2003. The decision has, however, worried much of Hawija's Sunni population, which makes up around 98% of the town, who fear that the Shiite militiamen might carry out sectarian-driven reprisals against the local population. The presence of Shiite fighters on the front line has remained a point of contention for many Sunni civilians, especially in Sunni-majority areas. These concerns are not unwarranted. Human rights organisations like Amnesty International, the United Nations and grassroots Iraqi NGOs have accused Shiite militiamen of carrying out killings and kidnappings across Iraq against Sunni civilians, particularly in areas liberated from ISIL. While Mosul is the biggest territory that ISIL holds, the group's defeat could spell an end to its self-proclaimed caliphate in Iraq. Hawija, although significantly smaller than Mosul, with a population of approximately 200,000 compared to Mosul's 2 million, is a strategically vital town which ISIS has used as a base to project into the country's north. While a strategically savvy move from the Iraqi government in order to encircle Baghdad's perimeter, aid workers and locals fear that any atrocities committed by the Shiite militias in Hawija could upset the delicate sectarian balance. Well, joining me now to answer some questions about this is Dr. Syed Amar Nashkawani, the Imam Ali Chair of Shia Studies at Hartford Seminary in the United States. So at such a time when various factions, including the Iraqi army and the Kurdish Peshmerga, are coming together to try to extirpate ISIS, why do people think that the Shiite militias would carry out atrocities against civilians? I mean, surely their attacks will be focused on ISIS.
It's very sad that people reach such a conclusion. Firstly, this is not a Shia issue. This is the whole of Iraq coming together to remove terrorism once and for all. The people who have gone towards Mosul or any of these areas are made up of Shia, Sunni, as well as Christians. And the main thing that unites all of them is Iraq. To just try and label this as being a Shia issue is plainly ridiculous.
There are those, however, who might point to, say, the 2014 report released by Amnesty International, which documented various atrocities being carried out by predominantly Shia militias in Sunni areas. What would you say to those people?
Once again, it's very sad that they've cornered this into a Shia issue. And I'm going to give you the best example. Having been someone who has visited Iraq, there are many who speak about Iraq, have not laid a foot in Iraq. I've been to Iraq, as many people know, my public profile, I go there virtually every 4 to 6 months. If you, for example, remember, let's say, Milosevic in Serbia, or you remember, for example, other dictators, other rulers, whenever there was a time of difficulty, you'd never expect the people who they had oppressed to come to their cities and seek amnesty. Would you believe, ever since the difficulties that have been faced by the Iraqi people due to ISIS. How many people from Mosul, from Ramadi, from Tikrit, from Fallujah, from all of these areas who are known, let's say, supposedly known by the name of Sunni, have come and sought sanctuary in Najaf, in Karbala, and in predominantly Shia areas?
Okay, Dr. Naqshbandi, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
There are, however, those who do not agree with Dr. Naqshbandi's conclusion. Earlier on, I caught up with Talha Abdulrazak, a researcher at the University of Exeter's Strategy and Security Institute and an Iraq specialist, and asked him if he agreed with Dr. Naqshbandi's conclusion that Shia sectarianism in Iraq is over-exaggerated.
I would wish what Dr. Naqshbandi was saying was actually reality. But sadly, I believe it's a fantasy because, you know, if you even look at the Sunni contingent in the army, it's minuscule. And the amount of Sunni, what they call tribal mobilization forces, you know, I have it on good authority from Kurdish sources just a week ago who told me that they don't reach more than even 6,000 in the area. So I'm not exactly sure what he's talking about there, especially when we're looking at the wider scope of the Iraqi army, which is, you know, completely Shia dominated. You know, it's a very high possibility that sectarian abuses will happen. They've happened in Tikrit, they've happened in Fallujah, they happened in Jurfa Sakhar, they happened in Ramadi, they happened in even Gayara not too long ago. These things will happen, have happened, and will continue to happen, sadly. And Mosul is the second largest city in Iraq. It's only going to get much worse, much deadlier.
Matthew Ayton, World in Focus.
The American journalist and documentary maker Daesh Losberg was arrested last Thursday and is now facing three charges of felony conspiracy, which bring with them a possible prison sentence of up to 45 years. Daesh was arrested in Walhalla, North Dakota, while filming protesters trying to shut down a tar sands oil pipeline carrying oil from Canada to the United States.
Two activists, Samuel Jessup and Michael Foster, were also arrested, with Mr. Foster facing additional charges of trespassing and criminal mischief. But few details are given about the complaint against Ms. Schlossberg, other than the fact that she was travelling in the same vehicle as the activists arrested. Schlossberg is not the only reporter facing charges for covering protests in North Dakota. Amy Goodman, host of American alternative news programme Democracy Now!, is due to hand herself over to authorities in North Dakota this afternoon.
She is now facing charges of participating in a riot for her report on the Native American-led pipeline protests. Daesh Losberg's colleague, documentary filmmaker Josh Fox, released an open letter of support on Friday, which has so far gathered over 16,000 signatures, along with an accompanying video with a reading of the letter.
Dear colleagues and friends, I regret to inform you that documentary filmmaker Daesh Losberg, producer of How to Let Go of the World and Love All the Things Climate Can't Change, was arrested while filming a protest action in North Dakota. She was held for 48 hours in Pembina County Jail without access to her attorney. This should send a chill down the spine of every documentary filmmaker and journalist. In my view, the North Dakota police are in violation of the First Amendment, charging a documentary filmmaker with conspiracy rather than viewing her as a reporter, journalist, exercising her First Amendment rights is unfair, unjust, and illegal. We need a show of support right now for Daya's immense courage and for the First Amendment. Now here is the really bad news, and this is why we need you to act right now. This afternoon, she was escorted to the courthouse where she was charged with three Class A and C felony charges that carry 45 years maximum sentence combined. She has been charged with two Class A felony charges and one Class C felony charge, conspiracy to theft of property, conspiracy to theft of services, conspiracy to tampering with or damaging a public service. These charges are a threat to our freedom of expression on the most basic level, and especially to documentary filmmaking. If we cannot film events as they're happening, especially protest events or events that the establishment and the police might consider crimes, we will never work or live in the same way again.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Still to come on the programme, Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte has hit the headlines again after telling Al Jazeera that he intends to investigate accusations of extrajudicial killings under his leadership. But we ask just how likely he'd be to see criminal charges brought for such crimes, even if he were to uncover them.
Today sees another historic shift in US-Cuba relations as the US lifts more restrictions. But is the freedom for tourists to bring back rum and cigars to the States just a symbolic move? And if it is, how far away are fully normalised relations between the two countries?
As China looks set to relax the law regarding religion, we'll be looking at critics of the new legislation who argue that this might be tighter surveillance than ever before, disguised as a liberalisation of the formerly strict atheist country's approach to faith groups.
And how best to marry your inner male and female sides, all will be revealed later in the programme.
I am willing to rot in jail for the Filipino. Di ba niyo maintindihan yan? So do not keep on threatening or intimidating me, calling my attention. It is not a crime even for a civilian Filipino walking the streets to say, I hate the criminals, I hope they would die, I will kill them if I catch them. Perfectly all right. That statement is in defense of my country and people.
Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte speaking yesterday during his three-day state visit to Brunei amidst international pressure from the likes of the European Parliament and the US government and the United Nations. Duterte has remained defiant in his defence of his so-called war on drugs and the associated spate of extrajudicial killings. That said, in an interview with Al Jazeera last week, President Duterte vowed to investigate the extrajudicial killings related to his drugs war, which has seen over 3,000 deaths in the short time since Duterte entered office.
Duterte's promise to investigate the killings, however, came with caveats, such as the suggestion that it could lead to absolutely no criminal charges being brought.
This is the law of my land. Here is a police. Here is a gangster. He's armed with an M16, the gangster only a pistol. But when they meet, they exchange fire. With the police with an M16, it's one burst, prrt, and hits 1,000 people there, and they die. There's no criminal liability.
Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte speaking to Al Jazeera last week. Duterte took office in June on a promise to rid the country of its illegal drugs trade by any means possible. Nicknamed the Punisher, Duterte built a reputation during his years as mayor of Davao for a hard-line approach to crime, including extrajudicial executions.
The president's critics have received these most recent assurances with scepticism, especially given his reaction to the recent Senate investigation led by Leila de Lima, not to mention external criticisms in response to which Duterte has been pretty uncompromising, for example, calling the United Nations stupid and more recently telling the US President Barack Obama to go to hell.
Instead of helping us, ang unang tumira itong State Department. So, you can go to hell. Mr. Obama, you can go to hell.
You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
The continued moves to normalise relations between the United States and Cuba stepped up a gear today as new changes come into effect. Those changes will see an easing in restrictions imposed by the US on Cuba with a view to improving scientific, humanitarian, trade and commercial ties between the two countries.
Amongst the package of relaxed restrictions is the lifting of the embargo on Cuban rum and cigars, a hugely symbolic shift given the strict rules which have forbidden travellers from bringing Cuban products into the US throughout the last 5 decades. Diplomatic relations between the US and Cuba were, of course, reopened in late 2014, and the slow thawing between the two historic adversaries has been continuing ever since, this despite concerns on both sides over human rights issues.
President Obama said in a recent statement, quote, "Very real differences between our governments persist on issues of democracy and human rights, but I believe that engagement is the best way to address those differences." The Cuban president has raised questions himself with regards to the US's record on human rights, saying, quote, "We find it inconceivable that a government does not defend and ensure the right to healthcare, education, social security and equal pay."
Associate Director of the Cuban Research Institute, Sebastian Arcos, joins me on the line now from Miami. Thanks for talking to us today, Mr. Arcos. Now, conventional wisdom goes that fully normalised relations between the US and Cuba would be through Cuba's adoption of free market capitalism, essentially. Is there any version of events that could see Cuba and the US achieve that sort of normal relationship without drastic changes to the Cuban economic model as it stands?
I don't see how that could happen, because the current economic system in Cuba is, even by the Cubans, the Cuban leadership, acknowledged as a failure. Cuba does not produce anything other than limited amounts of rum, cigars, and nickel cobalt that is operated by a Canadian company in the eastern part of the island. There is very little in the Cuban economy that actually works. And compare with the largest economy in the world, just 35 minutes flight away. The comparison is almost inconceivable.
Is it not, though? I mean, obviously the Cuban economy is not in a great shape, but is there not at least some argument there that the decades of isolation and sanctions imposed by the U.S. probably had a lot to do with that?
No, that is a self-serving argument created and by the Cubans. The primary reason why the Cuban economy is a disaster is the policies applied and enforced by the Fidel Castro regime beginning in 1960 that are still being enforced in Cuba. Cuba destroyed the entire base of the economy by confiscating not just the large companies that were owned by foreigners, particularly American companies, but also all large companies that were owned by Cubans, about 70% of the economy at the time, and then systematically every single other private piece of property in Cuba. Cuba went even farther than the Soviet Union in applying the socialist-communist model of complete ownership of the means of production by the state.
Just finally, then, if I could ask you, obviously there's been a lot of talk specifically from the US and from Barack Obama as these relations have been opening up with Cuba, saying that there are still concerns about human rights and so on. Is that really about a question about human rights concerns, or is that really about economics and about wanting a change in terms of the market in Cuba?
There are two ways of looking at this. One is what the administration argues that is the main goals of the new policy. And the other one is the reality that we see being implemented in the last year and a half, almost 2 years that the policy have been in place. Hmm. So the administration argues that their goal is to promote democracy, that the goal is to promote a more open society in Cuba by engaging the Cuban people and by helping and assisting the Cuban people to become independent from the state. The reality that we see in the implementation of these measures taken by the president, taking into consideration the economic and political realities on the ground in Cuba, indicate that the policy is, the explanations, the reasons given by the administration are just essentially a smokescreen.
So you don't think the U.S. wants any change on the part of the Cuban government?
Not this administration, no. And that represents a 180-degree turn from the traditional policy of the United States. So open society was first, economics was second. The Obama policy has turned it on its head and has put economics first and put human rights and democracy in the back burner.
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time, so we'll have to end it there. But thank you very much for speaking to us today, Sebastian Arcos.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.
Let's now update you on our breaking news story here on SE International. And all of our channels' bank accounts have been blocked in the UK without any explanation.
The TV news broadcaster RT's bank accounts have been blocked in the United Kingdom. That's according to reports on the channel following a statement from its editor-in-chief, Margarita Simonyan, who said, quote, "Our accounts in the UK have been closed. All accounts. The decision is not subject to revision. Long live freedom of speech." RT UK has since confirmed that the NatWest Bank had said that it had, quote, "reached the conclusion that we will no longer provide these facilities."
The letter from NatWest went on to say that, quote, "our decision is final and we are not prepared to enter into any discussion in relation to it." NatWest Bank is part of the RBS banking group, which is technically owned by the UK government after it was bailed out following the 2008 banking crisis. The UK Treasury is briefing that the government was not involved and that RT has not been added to any sanctions list. Roshan Salah is a journalist with Press TV and joins us on the line. Roshan, what were your initial thoughts to the decision taken by the RBS banking group today?
Well, it's like deja vu because it happened to me because I work for Press TV and exactly the same thing happened to us a few years back. And obviously, it's a political decision and it's designed to impede our ability to operate. So it's a direct attack on freedom of speech, because ultimately, if you attack the source of an organization's finances, you will eventually squeeze them and inhibit their ability to operate and to communicate effectively. And that's exactly what's happened to Press TV compared to how we operated in the UK before the sanctions were imposed and our bank accounts were closed down, etc. You know, we were much more effective voice. So this is all about silencing Russia today, I think. And I think it's also quite needless as well, because ultimately RT are, you know, compared to the government has enough levers to attack Russia. Through its political levers, its diplomatic levers, and also the media in this country are constantly attacking Russia. And RT are, compared to the British propaganda machine and political machine, RT are just a small voice, and you know, in the British media landscape. And therefore, and Press TV was a small voice in the British media landscape. So to attack it in this kind of direct way is completely needless, and it'll backfire because it just portrays the British state to be going against its own values. It trumpets its own values, such as freedom of speech, and these values are being directly undermined by its own actions. There are lots of, you know, state TV stations all around the world. Al Jazeera, Qatar, Press TV, Iran, TRT, Turkey, France 24, France. It only seems as though the state media operations which are allowed to thrive in this country are the ones which the British government and mainstream media agree with. So there won't be any attack on TRT, there won't be any attack on France 24 or Al Jazeera, but the ones that are targeted are the ones that the British government has a problem with on a political level, and that's Russia and Iran.
And do you think that this decision by RBS has been a decision that's come from the government rather than within the banking group itself?
Of course it is. They're putting pressure on them. And our experience on Press TV is that you ask them for their reasons, they won't give the reasons. And, you know, there's only one logical explanation, and that is that, you know, the state is putting pressure on them.
Mm. Well, Roshan Saleh, thank you very much for speaking to us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
China's relationship with religion has a checkered past, fraught with ideological clashes and suppression, but the country is also credited with the emergence of some of the most enduring religious movements of the world. Confucianism, Taoism, and of course Buddhism have all impacted massively on Chinese culture.
Since 1949, though, under Communist Party rule, religion in China has been somewhat confined to the shadows. It's not officially forbidden, but the Communist Party is an atheist institution, and its members are forbidden from practicing religion whilst in office. Under Mao Zedong's rule, religion was actively suppressed, though in the intervening years, things have become a lot less hardline. As a result, China's seen a growth in faith organisations like Islam and Catholicism, amongst others, and up until now, they've enjoyed a relative amount of autonomy. That could be about to change, however.
The Chinese government has announced plans for new regulations on religious activities, which some see as good news for faith groups. For example, such organisations will be permitted to officially set up social services like hospitals and nursing homes. But the new regulations have also raised fears that the authorities are looking towards a greater clampdown on religious organisations. Where before religious gatherings didn't require registration, in future they will. Where before online religious social networks were not subject to controls, in future they will be.
Ian Johnson is a journalist based in Beijing, and he joins me on the line now. Thanks for speaking with us today, Mr. Johnson. Is this a liberalisation of attitudes towards religion in China or a stealthy crackdown?
It's somewhere in between. Right now, the government tolerates a lot of illegal religious activity. They're trying to define the space for religion a little more carefully, but they still plan to keep and to allow religion. You have to remember that over the past 30 years or so, religion has exploded in China. The number of churches, temples, mosques, despite all the government control, has just continued to increase. And the government is not really opposed to religion per se. I think they just are worried that it could be used as a tool to oppose the Communist Party. And if there's any chance of that happening, they'll move strongly against it. And I think this is what these regulations are for. It's not really to affect ordinary worshippers.
As you said just there, there has been an explosion in religion in China in recent years. Why do you think that's happened?
Well, I think that China's now had almost 40 years of economic reforms. People have gotten a lot more prosperous, but the ethos of the country has suffered, according to a lot of people. There's this feeling that anything goes, that there's no morality in society. And, you know, a lot of people, one person put it to me and said, you know, we thought we were unhappy because we were poor, and now we are rich and we're still unhappy. So we're looking for other things in life. They're looking for, you know, answers to the big questions that drive all people. And I think religion is part of that. And it was heavily suppressed in the early phase of communist rule, and now it's a little, it's more relaxed, and so it's just sort of taken off.
In terms of this changing view towards it, though, from the government, is this a case of China catching up, as it were, with a rise of religion in the country, or has it always kind of been an elephant in the room that the government hasn't quite come to terms with?
Yeah, I think the government hasn't come to terms with it. They know that this has been happening, but they have been having a hard time getting a handle on it. And I think they're quite concerned that something could happen, that religion could become a force for change in society, say like the Catholic Church was in communist era Poland, or the Protestant Church was in East Germany. And that's the last thing they want. People want private piety, they want to worship. The government thinks that's okay, but they don't want civil society type activist groups to grow out of religion. Now, of course, religion always has a social component. It is, of course, deals with transcendence, but it also deals with the here and now. So it's a difficult balancing act, and I think these regulations are an effort to sort of deal with it, but I don't think they'll really be able to suppress it.
Well, Ian Johnson, thank you very much for talking to us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Also on the line to discuss this is Brent Fulton, who's the president of China Source. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Fulton. I wonder if you could perhaps tell us what the status of religion has been in China up until now.
Chinese policy towards religion in the last 30 years really hasn't changed much. And basically, the approach has been try to put religion in a box. And so you have five recognized religions in China, and you have five corresponding official organizations that are supposed to manage the religious activities for those five different religions. What's happened over the last 30 years as China has opened up is you have a lot of things happening in gray areas. And for the Christians, for example, you have actually more Christians meeting outside the official church in what's often called house churches than you do within the official church. And so then the government's left with this question of how do we put it back in the box or recognize that actually there's a lot happening outside the box, and how do we try to manage that?
The argument seems to be that whilst this looks initially like a great leap forward for religious freedom, that it could actually result in much tighter controls, as you kind of alluded to there, through more monitoring and surveillance of religious groups. Is this a fear that religious groups specifically are to be subject to more controls, or is this really more of a wider issue of surveillance in China?
Well, for the last few years, it's been a wider issue across society as the government has sought to increase more party control in literally every corner of the society. And so the fact that they're updating the draft, the new laws on religion, is not a surprise at all. Many people have been wondering when it's going to happen, and here we have. And so I think in the larger context, it's certainly not unexpected.
What do you think the legacy of this change will be then?
Well, I think it's important to note, first of all, this is a draft, and it could be changed based on comments from religious people in China that have been gathered over the last month. And so I don't think we are seeing the final version of it. On the other hand, as China continues to exercise more control over society, I think the legacy could potentially be greater control over organizations and groups that have kind of functioned in a big gray area outside the law for many years. Now they're going to be called to account.
So is this a step forward or a step backwards?
I think it's a mixed bag. On the one hand, the law does recognize, for example, the role of religious groups in doing charity work in China and gives them space to do that, and that's a good thing. On the other hand, it specifies even more clearly the implications for having unregistered meetings, religious meetings, the ways in which that will be enforced, and even the fines that are going to be leveled against those who have those kinds of meetings. That kind of specificity about how the law will actually be implemented, that's a real negative, and many religious believers in China today are very concerned about that.
Well, Brent Fulton, thank you very much for talking to us.
Okay, thank you.
And finally, Crystal Ra Laxmi believes that she has an inner woman called Crystal and an inner man called Ra. And if you believe that you have an inner woman and an inner man, which is easy for me to say, there's only one logical conclusion.
And what's that, Jack?
Well, you get married.
To yourself.
Well, I suppose it's not technically marrying yourself, it's marrying two sides of yourself together, which is exactly what she did at a ceremony in Estonia, in a proper wedding dress and everything. Here's a clip of the happy bride, newly married to herself, sharing her philosophy.
We let go everything which is blocking the feminine and the masculine to be united.
I'm sold.
Well, that's all we have time for, unfortunately, on World in Focus. You can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In a moment, we'll hand over to Washington, D.C. for Tom Hartman. Until tomorrow, from me, Jack Foster.
And me, Carolyn Scott.
Goodbye.